Are you struggling to find the right professional talent for your project? Are you working with a limited budget?
We are so excited about our next sponsor, Casting Networks. I have personally used Casting Networks to release a number of projects for free to the industry's largest network of professional performers for my commercial work and for my very first short film, Strange Thing.
Creators can manage submissions, schedule auditions, request and review self-tapes, and book top talent for their projects, all in one place. All for free.
On Casting Networks, you can create an account and send your casting call to thousands of professional talent. So join Casting Networks, the industry's preferred casting platform where more than 1.2 million performers have scheduled over 14 million auditions. That's a lot of auditions. Visit www.castingnetworks.com/movies to create an account for free today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out on digital and DVD now. Go watch it. Woohoo!
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in development on 1,000 more. I'm a distribution consultant who used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative, and I also do sales. This week, we welcome filmmaker Braden Doomler on the show to talk about making his first feature, What Lies Below, how it was put together, and what happened after his film was number one on Netflix. After that, we play another round of the game. But first, Arik, how are you doing?
Doing good. Doing well. Feeling more sane now. It's, I think, officially 2 weeks after the release of my movie. So, like, it's sort of died down a little bit. Yeah, I did my last bit of press last week, which was fun. But yeah, I feel like now I'm going to start doing some, like, Facebook ads for the movie, you know, and sort of kind of start pushing it a little bit more. I kind of stopped my barrage of social media posts that I was doing every day. I cooled off of it. Not kind of because I didn't have things to post, but more because I just got really busy with my day job. But yeah, the one thing, I'm going to appeal to our audience members again, like I have been. The thing that has been, you know, we've got lots of nice IMDb ratings and things. I mean, we could have more good ones. We are declining, but the thing that we don't have enough of is Rotten Tomatoes, you know, audience scores. We don't have enough for a rating. So if anyone is a Rotten Tomatoes person and you have an account, go over to Rotten Tomatoes and tell people what you think of the movie. Give a review. Give a rating. That would be great. I felt like doing one for myself, but I kind of felt like, oh man, then my name's going to pop up and it's going to be like all Rick rating his own movie. Like, that's really
just use a lame. Fake name. Just do a fake account and a fake name. Have you not done that before?
No. I have integrity. Liz, I'm just kidding. No, I
have no integrity when it comes to self-promotion. Come on. Like, that's part of the whole game is like, anyway, is kind of bending the rules to make your product stick out a little bit more.
Yeah, totally. Well, I should get on that. But yeah, anyone who's on there who already has an account, it would be great. That would be much appreciated. Yeah, the movie I've been working on, we did another pass of the script, or many passes. Basically, I'll give a note to the writer and then he'll just do it before I give the next note. And so, like, he just keeps on revving up. He just can't stop working on it. But yeah, we're on draft 20 now. It's probably more really like draft 14, maybe.
Wait, what color is draft 20? What color? Wait, you haven't locked color. Pages yet, right?
No.
Okay.
Oh, he wanted to. I was like, no, we can't lock pages before we cast the movie. Like, that's insane. Because all the, you know, if we get the kind of cast that we want, they'll probably have notes. We don't have a distributor yet. When we get a distributor, they'll probably have notes. It's like, it's way too early to lock pages. You know, once we have a date and, like, you know, we've noodled with it enough, we've made everyone happy, then we can lock pages. But I think we're way far away from that. But we did send it out to one of our first actors through a connection. So it's not through an agent. It's like a direct connection to a person we've all heard of. So we'll see how it goes. Fingers crossed. You know, it's super long shot, right? Like, it's like, even through the friend, it's a long shot. But it's like, you know, if it works out, that would be amazing. You know, and in the very least, we were hoping we get an answer quicker than normal because it's like, you know, he could just text him. So that definitely helps. But we'll see. Who knows? These things are all crazy. But yeah, I'm feeling very excited about the movie. I'm working on a schedule now just so I can, like, kind of figure out exactly, like, what we want to offer all the actors, you know? Okay. Because we don't really know Like, we have a rough idea of how many days we need everybody, but until I actually do a schedule, I won't be able to say for sure, like, we need this character for this days, this character for that days. And so, rather than trying to hire someone to do it, I just figure, I've done it before. Like, the software that is really cheap, like, just to get it for a month, so I can just do it myself as my next task. So, rather than writing my next movie, I'm just continuing to work on this.
Huh.
Maybe it'll all be all for naught. Maybe it will pay off in big dividends. We don't know yet. But it's still fun to work on it. So, but yeah, what's going on with you, Liz?
I am more self-conscious about things that I say because I'm starting to feel like people listen to this podcast and it's making me more nervous about what I share on a regular basis. So I'm going to try to think before I talk in the next few minutes. The horror anthology that I've been talking about, we have invited our fourth filmmaker to it and we just offered him the position, and he is a friend of the show, Nathan Ruger, who made a wonderful short that plays on Alter right now, and I haven't even asked if it's okay that I say something, but I think he'll say it okay.
Well, yeah. He's been on the show before, like, in brief ways, so yeah, I'm sure he's okay with it. Plus, his short was really good.
It was really good.
It was a really good short.
Well, so we'll see how that grows. The idea is, like, now the four of us, me, Amy, Sean, and Nate, are going to figure out what the anthology is going to be about and thematically and who else should be a part of it. But it just feels nice to have four different perspectives. Are you raising your hand? Okay, well then we'll throw you in officially into the pod and talk to you about it if you would like to. That would be very fun.
I mean, I don't want to be presumptuous. There's lots of great filmmakers out there. So feel free, you know, to not pick me. But if you want to pick me.
Well, I think we should talk to you. I think that would be lovely. And because it's going to be a four-person group decision now. And you might hate all of us. Like, it's a two-way street, Ulrich. Like,
well, I think I like all of you already.
Oh, okay. So, well, you don't know Sean. He's the bad apple of the bunch.
I've talked to Sean just a tiny enough to know that I appreciate his sense of humor.
He's
and then
okay.
His love of Joe Bob, you know, I feel
helps.
Like there's enough connection points there.
I think so.
But maybe he hates me. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll find out. So there's that. And then I'm feeling the pressure to really clamp down on something for 2023. Like, I'm feeling it. Like, it's like there's like a fire here.
More than the anthology, like another project?
I don't think the anthology is necessary. Like, if it's 2023, it's going to be like summer 2023. I think we're going to need time to build it, write our shorts, really figure out what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this horror feature that me and Amy are doing most likely will be 2023, but we still have to fundraise for it. And I'm feeling very anxious that I don't have a plan. And then I'm attached to this sci-fi film where we're really cooking. Like, we have a sales company attached. We have two talent attachments. We're out to two more. You know, things are happening, but it's all still feels substanceless. It's like, really, really?
So what's holding that project back then?
Well, we don't have funding. Yeah, it's like until the talent is attached, the talent will greenlight the pre-sales from the international sales company we have on board.
So the two, so you need more talent. So the two you have aren't enough to warrant
the budget that we need.
Interesting.
You know, it's interesting, and you kind of watch it with like a superstitious hope, just like you have, right? It's like, this could be something, but I don't want to get too excited. So who knows? And so I'm just waiting and trying not to put too much on it, right? Not too much pressure on it. But I'm just feeling like at a certain point, like it's September, like I need to figure out what's going in 2023. And that's what I'm feeling right now. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're like, you want to know if it's like, is it the horror movie with Amy? Is it this other movie?
Or are we going to prioritize the anthology all of a sudden? Like, is that going to take the front run? Because that seems like the easiest to do, in all honesty, right? Because it's like,
well, it still costs money though, right? That you have to raise.
Well, my idea is we would each self-fund our own shorts.
Interesting.
Yeah. If people want to find an investor to fund their short, you know, they can find one. They have autonomy over the financing of their project, and liability lies with them as well.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting.
And then when I'm now you're like, I don't want to do it anymore.
No, I find it. It's engaging. It's like, I love it because it's sort of like, oh, you want to direct a fucking short in this anthology? Well, here's what you need to do if you want to do that. You're like kind of putting it on the filmmaker, which is like totally how it should be, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like I can imagine a lot of people like having the same reaction you're saying, like, oh, okay, well, never mind that.
No one's reacted that way yet. Has been like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But my radical suggestion is like, no matter how little or how much you put into the film, if you're selected to be part of the anthology, every main figurehead, like every contact person for their film, every owner of the film gets equal disbursement in distribution. Wow. You choose how much you want to spend, right? Like, I don't want to police that, but we're partners in the release of the film. And that's exciting to me.
Is there like some sort of checks and balances if like, you know, one filmmaker or part of the group doesn't deliver at the same level as the rest?
So that's the whole thing is like, we have to create a model. That's why the casting of the projects is so important, where people are very invested in making high quality storytelling. And that part of the buy-in is that we can give each other notes on each other's projects, and it's a collaborative process. You're not working in a vacuum, and you don't need the approval of others, but you would want to collaborate with each other to make your project better. So if you could do it all for $0, I don't care, as long as, we hit a certain production value in terms of technical specs and aesthetic wonderment, proficiency, whatever you want to use. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then like making sure the stories are all kind of thematically tied together.
So we're starting like a bi-monthly, every 2 weeks meetings, so that we all decide on what the theme is together, and we all decide what we want to do as a team.
Oh, nice. Awesome. Yeah. Very cool.
So we'll see how it goes. But all right, I'm going to email you about this after this recording.
I'd love to talk.
But everyone else, don't forget to support us on Patreon, www.patreon.com/MMIH podcast. We want to wish a Patreon birthday to Mark Pilvinsky, who is actually the writer of a film I'm attached to. So it's just very cool that he was supporting the podcast. He wrote a wonderful script called The Black Lodge. Thank you for the support, Mark. We asked Mark what he wanted to say, and he said that he has a feature doc called Weirdo, the story of 5'8 coming out next year. And it's about the rock band 5'8 from Athens, Georgia. And a mental health crisis launched them in 1988, and they've never stopped putting out great records and blowing people away in rock clubs. I mean, like, that's an intriguing log line. What is this mental health crisis? Like, tell me more. And then he also wanted to say that he loves the game. So thank you, Mark, for loving the game. We're going to keep doing it. We're doing it in this episode. And he loves the alternate. He rented it and thought it was great. So,
thanks, Mark.
Everyone should listen to Mark and check it out.
Oh.
Finally, check out the internet. Oh, not finally. There's still more. There's so many more sponsors.
So much more.
Check out the International Screenwriters Association, which is an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through the programs they offer. They have consultation courses, contests, the top 25 writers list featuring some of the best writers. So head on over to networkisa.org to sign up for free today. But without any more delay, here's our chat with Braden Doomler. Hi, Braden. Do you mind giving us the elevator pitch for What Lies Below?
I knew you were going to ask this because I listened to so many of the episodes. Sure, I haven't done this in a while. What Lies Below is about a 16-year-old girl named Liberty who comes home from summer camp to realize her mom has met a man, and the man is an absolute Adonis. And for the first time in her young adult life, there's a little bit of a sexual curiosity ignited in Liberty. And that sexual curiosity seems to be met and, you know, responded to by the man, John Smith. And so they start to get closer and closer, and you're wondering what's going on. And all of a sudden, one night, middle of the night, Liberty gets woken up to this bright orange light coming out the back window of her room. She looks out the window, and the light is emanating from inside the lake, deep in the lake. And John Smith is standing on the shore, just basking in the light. And then all of a sudden, John Smith walks towards the light, walks completely under the water, disappears, and the light clicks off. And the rest of the film is, you know, what's going on with my stepdad? And that's pretty much the elevator pitch. That's what I used, at least.
That's amazing.
And no spoiler alert, but that's the premise.
Nice.
Yeah.
How many days did you shoot the film?
So we were supposed to shoot 20. And the day that there's lampreys in the film, and the day the lampreys were supposed to show up, they didn't show up. So we lost an entire day of production. We just sat there basically with nothing to do because Mina was not called to set that day. And we couldn't shoot anything in that basement scene without her. So as a result, we were literally sitting around for a day and not doing anything. So it was a 19-day shoot, if you can believe it, that was supposed to be 20. And then we did one pickup in LA at Abel Vane, who's one of the producers' garage. And that was it. Yeah. It was shot in upstate New York, which is a beautiful location. Highly recommend. the infrastructure is not there yet, but it's worth it for the locale.
For those who aren't aware, lampreys are...
Yes. Lampreys are parasite. They're parasitic eels that live on their hosts, and they're one of the few species that go from saltwater to freshwater and back and forth with no problems.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What was the rough budget?
Well under $1 million, from what I understand, around 700,000, somewhere around there.
And then how did you come up with the idea for the movie?
I think it was inspired by the poster for, what's it, like the From the Sky, or there's this sci-fi film. Oh my gosh, I can't remember the name of it all of a sudden.
Fire in the Sky?
Thank you, Fire in the Sky. And I just, I kept obsessing over that image of just this light going into somebody's chest. And I thought it was so interesting. And then when I was, you know, I was thinking a lot about that image, I reflected on my own childhood. One of my first ever crushes was actually on my stepmom when I was 8 years old. And it was really cute. She always used to, she loves to tell people about the story about how I used to, you know, run up to her when my dad wasn't looking, you know, pull her on the shirt and say, you know, try to chase me around and try to kiss me on the cheek. And I would run around the room and she would try to chase me and all these things. And it's super adorable. But if the roles are flipped and it's, you know, an adult male with a little girl, then all of a sudden it gets a little bit hairy, right? And so that's kind of what I did. And I combined that with the light in the lake. And then I built out the mythology of, or the ethology of John Smith. And that's how it all came together.
How long did you spend working on the film from that first, looking at the poster for the first time to its eventual release?
Do you mean when the, like the finished poster, or do you mean from the moment I started writing it to the moment
I... From the moment you were inspired till the moment the film came out.
That's a good question. It had to be 3 or 4 years, at least. The actual script that we used was probably like only the second draft, because I ended up doing a table read, which I love to do with my scripts if I can. I get as many friends as I can after I finish a rough draft. And we sit in a room and I host and I, you know, bring dinner and try to, you know, make it a fun event. And we do a table read and I record it. And there was a palpable reaction to every beat in the film, in the room. And afterwards, Anna James turned to me and goes, Brad, you have to fucking make this. And I was like, okay, good note. You know, I listened to feedback. There was a couple, I think Nick Burleston was in the room too. He gave some great notes. And my friend Ritesh.
Ritesh has been on the show. Anna James has been on the show.
Okay. So yeah, Ritesh was in the room. Julian Volchan was in the room. And they all gave like really good notes. And I went back and, you know, there were some things that I could just never solve from the script. And I realized that, but there was a lot of things I was able to figure out based on that. And then we were, I mean, I would say, I don't know if you want the whole story of how it came together, but Jimmy Liu, who's one of my best friends from USC, came back from China. He'd been shooting in China for a long time. And basically we met up and he's like, what are you working on, man? Like, let's do something. And I sent him like 3 or 4 low budget scripts that I had. I think I sent him 4 scripts and he read them all, which is just, I love Jimmy. He's just so, he's such a supporter of other people. And he turns to Viscous and he was like, this is the one. Viscous is the original title of What Lies Below. What Lies Below got changed because people didn't understand what Viscous meant. And so he turns to Viscous and he says, we can do this for low budget. And so the original plan was, we're going to make it for $200,000. You know, we're going to do it with, he introduced me to his friend who also went to USC, but I didn't have any sort of relationship with prior, Abel Mang. Abel brought on another producer named Stephen Stanley. I brought on a producer named Christina Esposito. We had a small amount of money to work with to begin with, enough to put money into escrow and make an offer to a actress. We targeted the role of Michelle, which is the mother, and she's supposed to be, she's actually based off Anna James' personality, if you can believe it. She's supposed to be big and over the top and like, you know, super open about everything. And we found this incredible cast and director named Katrina Wendell George. She was gung-ho. She loved the script. She related to it. She just immediately connected to it. Like the first person she wanted us to go out to was Isla Fisher. We did go out to Isla Fisher. We actually had a little bit of back and forth with Isla Fisher, which is like the coolest thing ever because I'm a huge fan of hers. And then eventually we landed on Mina, who I was also a huge fan of because, you know, she's incredible.
Mina Suvari.
Yeah, Mina Suvari. Sorry, shorthand. And as soon as Mina got attached, then all of a sudden it went from being this $200,000 budget to, okay, we can actually, there can actually be money here. And so Steven actually ended up getting some pre-sale offers and all these different things started happening. And eventually the entire budget came together and we were off to the races. Wow. So it worked out really well and very quickly, actually. But, you know, and this is something I learned from you, Liz, was it was all dependent on the cast. And I remember having a meeting with you when I was had all these low budget scripts. I was trying to figure out what to do with them. And you said, Brad, it's all about the cast. You know, that's 99% of it. And so I took that to heart and made sure we got the best casting director we could. And we went after the top talent that we could. And we were really fortunate to find Emma and Trey, who are both like going off right now. Emma's in Lord of the Rings and Trey's in Heels.
Wow.
And they really filled out the cast. So it was great.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of other questions, but there's one last one. Compared to all the other projects you've made, how difficult was this one to make?
Oh, man. It was easy in the sense that I was very comfortable with the story and confident in the story. It was difficult in the sense that it was just a battle. Like every film is a battle and it's a war of attrition. And I feel, I don't know how to break it down into small things that happened. It was just a lot of things that compounded in the end and just made it into such a difficult thing. You know, the lamprey is not showing up one day. I think every day it took us 3-4 hours to set up, which was an internal problem that was an issue that we couldn't really fix because we were in the middle of nowhere and we couldn't get reinforcements to fix the problem. We were just up against it every single day. And on sets before, I've wrapped early all the time, you know, like, okay, we got everything we need. We're good. And this was just, everything was just a struggle. And I mean, my shot list was going from 16 shots to like 8 to get our day, you know?
Yeah.
It was nothing against, like, our camera department was fantastic. You know, all, like, there was great departments. There was just something that was going on internally that was just slogging everything down. And so it felt like you were Sisyphus just pushing that boulder up that cliff over and over and over again, only for it to roll right over again.
Wow.
I still remember one day, the first week of production, please stop me if I'm talking too much or whatever. Yeah. It was a Friday and we were so behind that week that we had to shoot 12 pages that day.
Oh.
Jimmy and I were looking at this and going, oh my gosh. And one of them's the dinner scene, which is, you know, three people's coverage, which is one of the few scenes there's three people's coverage. And one of them was the living room scene where John winks, which is also the three person's coverage. And there's a lot more blocking in that. We weren't optimistic about it, Jimmy and I. And we ended up getting to the living room scene and only having 3 hours to shoot it, which is like a 6-page scene with three people. It's a lot. And despite that, we got it together. I actually made the conscious decision to leave Mina's coverage for last because I knew she was such a rock star. She was just going to bring it every take and just keep bringing it. And I'm glad we did because it just helped. Because we only got one take with her for a lot of her shots, you know, because wow. We were just moving so fast. And then she still nailed it every time. And at the end of the whole thing, we wrapped with like 2 minutes to spare. And I was just screaming like, yeah, like, you know, because I'm a sports player, an athlete growing up. So when, you know, you score the goal to win the game or you win the game in overtime, you just freak out. And I'm just yelling and giving everybody high fives and everyone's just, like wrapping their stuff, trying to get out for the day. And it was like, that was the one thing that I think turned the tide from it being like, we're going down a bad direction here to, we can do this. It's going to be a battle, but we can do this. And I was really proud of us that day because we just all kind of banded together and really got it done, despite it being up against us with so many pages to shoot in such a short amount of time, which is probably average for you guys, like 12 pages a day. You're like, yeah, didn't you shoot like 12 days on your sets or something insane?
Well, I did, but I had like an 80-page script, you know? I mean, like, it was very, I think 12, it sounds very ambitious.
Okay. Well, thank you for making me feel better.
All the things you're saying, Braden, are bringing me right back to my shoot because it was like every day I was like, okay, how can we not go over today? How can we make the day? Like, we're going to, like, I was just terrified of going over every day. And we went over a lot of days. We had to cut tons of stuff. Every day we had to cut something. Our shoot went from 15 days to 19 days. So we went over budget.
Yeah.
I was just a wreck, like trying to to stay on top of everything. Every day it took usually at least 2 hours to set up, sometimes three, you know, because we were in certain sets that were really confined.
Yeah, I noticed that.
And our DP is very, like, you know, meticulous and, like, perfect about everything. And which, like, at the time I was like, let's just shoot that. Right. It looks great. Why do we need another half hour to get this? Who cares? Let's shoot this movie. And then, like, now after I watched it and then working on another movie that was, like, you know, way more low budget than that. And with this much smaller crew where we would just shoot it. And then watching both, it's like, I love that other movie too, but it's like the way that our film looks versus that, it's like very different. And like, I've basically realized that, oh yeah, that 2 hours, 3 hours setup or whatever, that was worth it. And it was worth it to cut all that other stuff we had to cut, because the movie looks special and the way it does because of those 2 to 3 hours. And I mean, just look at your trailer. It looks like, you know, similar thing. Like, your movie looks beautiful. And
thank you.
That time is why, you know? And so we have to suffer through sometimes, like, the wait, because, you know, like, it doesn't have to happen.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said with, you know, what comes out of limitations. Like, with your film, I really love the way you did the split screens. You didn't just do a split screen. You took it as an opportunity to do, like, separate spaces, you know, like, where there was this dynamic of him being way, you know, one of them being way in the background and one of them being up front. And there was this divide between them and the door frame. And I thought that was so brilliant, because it wasn't just doing the minimum of a split screen. It was actually using the split screen to tell the story as well, because you could have them both in focus. And I really love that. Yeah.
Well, we used split diopters for all those shots, which, like,
we
didn't have to do, because in visual effects, we could have just done it, like, just rack the focus or whatever. But, like, we were really, like, inspired by Brian De Palma and the way that he uses split diopters, and we wanted to really capture that look. So they like, a lot of those split screens, like, look a little sloppy because of the split diopter we used, and it's actually, like, the old camera, like,
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Technique, and then we got dinged by a couple of reviewers. They're like, oh, this looks sloppy visual effects. And you're like, no, that's really actually just the way the split diopter looks when you have it, like, going from one to the other, you know.
I didn't see that at all. I thought they looked super clean. And I get that. Like, you know, when you're shooting low budget, it is a battle with your DP where you have to. I mean, I love Jimmy. Jimmy and I are so close that we argue on set, and Jimmy sometimes and I have to pull aside and go, we got to stop arguing because we're setting the wrong tone for everyone else, you know, because we're so close that we can, like, yell and argue at each other, you know, not in a mean way. We just get really passionate about our ideas. Right.
Right.
And people think, like, people will literally walk up to Jimmy and go, are you okay, man? Like, what's going on? Like, they don't know. And Jimmy will laugh and go, yeah, it's fine. We're good. We're like brothers, you know? But there is that thing where you're trying to get all the shots you need from the story, but also you need the film to be at a bare minimum of quality to be able to sell it, to put it out there, you know?
Yeah.
The DP is conscious of that, you know, Jimmy, in my case, Jimmy was conscious of that. And me, I'm going, I only got 9 shots. I need 2 more to tell this. I just need 2 more, you know, like, and then I got this covered. I totally get that battle. And it is, I wonder how much it, one thing I will say too, is we always were aware of which shots were the trailer shots, and we took extra time with those, you know. When I set out to write a script and to actually shoot a movie, I actually write a trailer script as well, because I want to know what the trailer is going to be, so I know which scenes are going to be in it, because I want to spend extra time and make sure that they really pop. And I also want to know if I should get some extra lines on set that might help tell the trailer in a more succinct way, tell the story in a succinct way in order for it to go into the trailer. So sometimes, you know, we'll be after a take and I'll just say, Mina, you know, can you say this line and just, you know, shoot it off with the same intention, and she'll shoot that line off. And then that ends up in the trailer, even though it never was in the film. I think that's key for us at low budgets, because ultimately the trailer is I feel what sells our films and really gets it done on top of the cast. You know, I mean, there's going to be distributors that won't even look at your film because you don't have the cast. We had that, yep. You know, where they're like, yeah, there's not enough cast here, and they won't even look at the trailer. But then, you know, the other ones, you can hopefully at least get them excited about it with that. Lots of people will watch a minute and a half, no matter how busy you are. They won't read a script. They won't look at your budget. They won't look at this long-winded email, but they'll watch a two-minute trailer. And I think that's the key, you know?
I want to ask a little bit about cast, because I've been dying to ask about Mina Savari. Not like the question of like, what was it like working with Mina Savari? But this concept of foreign pre-sales and actors of a certain time period, genre, milieu. I mean, Mina Savari, the general association with her is American Pie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, I'm in development right now on several films, and all of the sales companies are drawn towards late 90s, early 2000 commercial actors.
Oh, wow.
And I'd be curious why you thought Mina Savari greenlit fundraising for you, and why she's thought of as such a popular commodity. Like, why? I would say, like, the layman, laywoman on the street might not automatically assume that about her.
Yeah. So there's what I think personally, and there's what I think the industry thinks.
Yeah.
What I think, for me, I'm terrible with actors and actresses and names and stars. So I'm kind of the ultimate barometer on whether someone is worth anything, I think, because if you say a name to me and I recognize the name, yeah, you probably have somebody that has value, you know? If you say a name to me and I don't recognize the name, then maybe not. And sometimes, you know, I can go off a poster too, because I know thumbnails are such an important thing in our industry now too, right? Is what face can you put on a thumbnail so that they click on the thumbnail, maybe watch the trailer, and then maybe decide to buy the movie, right? And so I'll look at faces too. And if I recognize a face, you know, oh, they were from this, that's probably a good thing. But if I just see a face, I'm like, oh, I kind of recognize them, you know, like that's probably not. But then the reason I think that the distributors are interested in that era, my belief is that Europe, Asia, these other markets that are very valuable to foreign sales are a little bit behind us culturally, like as far as Hollywood is concerned, right? They see a movie after us, it gets popular after us. And so they might lag a little bit in who is their stars and how much part of the public consciousness they are. Whereas Mina might have been, I don't want to say forgotten, but like more like not as recognizable now for us. She might be still pretty recognizable star in some of these other areas because they're just a little bit behind.
And I also, I recognize that I didn't mention American Beauty, and I felt like shitty about that.
No.
That seemed like an obvious.
Honestly, she might not even mind that because she's probably so tired of being associated with the girl from American Beauty, you know? And I do think that writing that role was a conscious decision too, because women over the age of, let's say, 40 in our industry tend to be cast aside, you know? So there's a really, really talented pool of women and actresses who are not getting the offers, not getting the roles, and not getting the opportunities. And you're sitting there going, this person is incredible. Why aren't they in films all the time? Like, I remember when we were going to go out to meet, I watched some of her more recent work, which were a few of the films that she had done in the last couple of years. And I was like, oh my God, this actress is so underrated. Like, she's so talented. Mm. And she's just sitting there, and we can make an offer to her. Yeah, let's do it. You know, it's kind of crazy. But yeah, you do have to think about that. You have to think, what is the role that you can shoot in 10 days? And is a role that fits a demo of a person who might not be getting as many offers as the Leonardo DiCaprios of the world, you know, or even much further down on that list. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, she's come up multiple times with different producers for me, like, oh, we try to get Mina because she's great. She'll sell a movie. Like, you know, do you have any movie that will with a character for her? Oh, let's go after, like, we got our agent, blah, blah, blah. And then like my other producer was talking about like her being on his list of actors that to consider for, you know, $1 million movies or $2 million movies or whatever. So I don't know. She thinks she's having a moment right now or something. Cause like she did three movies in 2020 and like four or five in 2021. And she's got like five that are supposed to come out in 2022. So
she's like,
yeah, she's back on
it, man.
Yeah, she's getting back into it.
Like Alicia Silverstone's another one. There's like a lot of these actors from that era, like a Ryan Phillippe on the male side.
It's Julia Stiles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Julia Stiles. Like they're all selling these low budget movies, and it's pretty amazing. It's really cool that they get to have this whole other career of making movies after their big heyday, you know?
Yeah, and they have this great ability to take a unknown director and just say, you know, yeah, I believe in you. I'm gonna do this with you.
Yeah.
I still remember meeting Mina in a coffee shop for the first time. I was so freaking nervous. And you know, she's sitting down and she's grilling me, as she should, about, you know, the film and how I'm gonna shoot it and how we're gonna pull it off for such a low budget and what all everything means, how it all connects, you know, and I'm just, you know, trying to be as on point and as succinct as possible. And afterwards she goes, okay, great. It was wonderful meeting you. You know, she shakes my hand and she leaves. I'm like, fuck, I messed up. You know, she didn't agree to be in the film. And I was so upset. I was like, I didn't know how the industry worked. And I'm like, I'm walking out of the shop. I'm going, what did I say something inappropriate? Like, I thought I was super polite, you know, like what happened? And then I'm driving my car and I shoot, you know, 5 minutes later, Abel Vang, my producer, calls me. He goes, Brad, I got tough news. He goes, what? And he goes, Mina wants to be in the film. I was like, oh my God. And so I was freaking out. I pulled over. I was yelling. I was so excited. Called my family and my friends and told them, you know, we just got a person, you know, a huge, really talented actress to agree to come to our film. And it paved the way, you know, and that's what's great about, you know, actors in that position is that they can single-handedly get a movie made.
Yeah.
You know, and they can launch someone's career if it's the right, you know, fit. So it's great.
So I have a kind of a more of like emotional mental state.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of the release of my movie right now. You're like a year and a half out from your release. When you were like getting the responses, like, you know, reviews are coming in, user reviews are coming in, ratings are coming in. Like,
yeah.
How do you deal with that? Like, what's your process for processing all that information? Or do you just ignore it?
I wish I could ignore it. It was probably one of the darkest times of my most recent life, to be honest with you. It's people are really, really cruel out there. And what I try to remind myself is that Twitter is a platform for hate. You know, people go on Twitter 90% of the time to hate on things. And I also realized that we did things that were really uncomfortable for certain people. You know, we have menstruation in the film. We have a negative line towards Donald Trump in the film. And I have gotten death threats in Portuguese because of that line.
Wow.
On my Instagram.
Wow.
You know, who knew that Donald Trump had so much support in Brazil? But apparently he does.
Wow.
So I guess what I just keep reminding myself is I would show the film to anyone with confidence. I believe in the film. I think we made a strong film, and they can, whoever wants to hate on it and do it, you know, that's really at the end on them. And, you know, certain things about our society, you know, like why menstruation is so taboo, I'm not quite sure. And why people decided to come out in droves to hate on us for Donald Trump, you know, even though they claim that we're the snowflakes, you know. You know, maybe I shouldn't go down this rabbit hole. I know what you're going through, man. It's really tough. You just have to, like, I watched your film. You made a really great film. And I know how tough it is at that budget to make. And Liz, Speed of Life. I've seen Speed of Life. I've seen Bread and Butter. You guys made great films. I know how tough it is at that level. Like, you guys, it's a battle. Like, nobody online knows what that's like. The reviewers don't know. The people on Twitter don't know. They have no idea how hard it is to make them, right? They see films all the time and they think they're experts on it because of it. Whereas the reality is that we're the ones in the trenches, in the battles, trying to just survive, trying to just make it through our day with the shots in our head. And we know what it's like. We know how difficult it is. So just remind yourself of that and just remind yourself that there are people out there. And every time you have somebody reach out to you and say, hey, I really loved your movie, keep that and cherish that. That's a small victory. I just last night went to a screening because a fan of the film reached out to me on Instagram and said, Brad, I loved your film. It was one of my favorites from last year. I would love to connect with you. I'm an actor and a producer in the world. And he invited me to this film screening that he did last night. And met with him and we hit it off. It was great talking to him. And he was just so complimentary of the film. And I go through rough times still. Like, I had a number one movie on Netflix and I have trouble getting anyone to read my stuff, and that's really a reality check. You think, oh, it was number one, it beat out Idris Elba's Concrete Cowboy. It, beat out a Easter movie on Easter, this is good. We're doing good. And you think the doors are going to open now and they don't really open yet. So you just have to keep having faith in yourself. And like I said, we just all have to say we made good films. I would show that film to anyone. I would have complete confidence showing that film to anyone.
Nice.
And that's what you have to say. And the problem is just getting people to watch it, to look past the hate that's out there for certain reasons and to watch it,
Can you speak to go on, Arik.
I was going to say, you had a lot of people watch your movie. I mean, goodness, God damn, a lot of people watched it, which is like, I think, on the other side of it, it's like, people shit on it for fun or whatever. But like, you had so many people that you reached, which is really an amazing thing, So
can you speak to that day to day after the movie came out? I mean, like, how are you sustaining your life? But also, like, did representation come to you? Did you get representation? I know that you're having trouble getting people to read your script, but like, how are you pounding the pavements? Like, what advice would you give other filmmakers in terms of strategy?
Advice I would give is that you just have to constantly do things yourself and do it with people you trust. Like, I'm still working with one of the producers from that film. Abel and Burley are actually like taking off right now. They did another low budget film called They Live in the Gray that became a Shudder original. And now they're like on a trajectory, like crazy trajectory. And they're doing great. They have this huge project that they're working on that they won't even tell me the details, so I can't share them with you, but it sounds like it's a big deal. And so I connected with Steven because I really vibe with him. And he's been doing this the longest out of all of us. And Steven Stanley has been really pounding the pavement. And, we have gotten reads. It's not like we haven't. It's just everything is like, okay, so call us back when you have cast. We're like, well, we have no money. We have no money for cast. So, and then we have to get the cast to read the script without us having any financing in place, which is an issue because, you have roadblocks. Fortunately, I do have a assistant at WME who loves What Lies Below. His name is Alberto, and he's kind of like my de facto agent. And he's, constantly trying to say, read this guy's stuff. He's good. Like, just please read the stuff. And so having that person on the inside helps a lot. Having my casting director, Katrina, she's a big advocate for us as well. She's got relationships to agents and she's trying to get us read all the time, and so it's a lot of things like that. And another thing is, the next film I'm trying to make is a $5 million budget. I want to try to move up, and, that might not be in the cards. People might still not trust me with that amount of money. So while I've been kind of working on this, I've written two other scripts that more are $2 million ones. So I'm just constantly writing, that's the only thing I can really control, right? It's the only thing that costs no money in this industry, except your time, is that script, is that blank page. And so when people are getting, upset or distracted in something, I always tell people, harness it and put it down into the pages you write. That's literally all you have. And it's still a creative outlet. It doesn't matter. I might end up never making another film in my entire life, but I'll still write screenplays and I can always write them and I can always have them. I have plenty. I got like 14 screenplays at this point. I might as well just keep writing, like, why not? Right. It's fun. It's a battle, but it's just a battle with yourself, and it makes you a better person, I think, every time you write and you overcome your own insecurities, that nagging feeling that you're not good enough, that you're an imposter, all those things that you tell yourselves. Every time you finish a screenplay and you write the end on the end of it, it's like you beat that part of your mind, like you overcame that. And so I would say that's the best way to use your energy if it's not trying to actually physically get it made. I don't know if I answered your question.
I loved whatever you did. It was so wonderful.
You asked after the film. After the film, yeah, I didn't have, I had Alberto reach out on Instagram, and he was moving to LA to work at WME. And so we've been in touch. XYZ, their actually management arm is who discovered the film. And so the manager set up an interview with me. It was a week before the pandemic. We seemed to hit it off. I was like, oh, cool. Like, I'll get repped by XYZ. This is huge. And then the pandemic hit and I reached back out and they said, we just can't take on any more clients right now. And so I understood that. And like, I get that, you know, it is what it is. Now I can just keep focused on what I can, which is the writing, which is trying to get people to read the stuff that I do have. Actually, the other day, like one example of what I try to do is I went to a screening. I teach at NYFA, or I used to teach at NYFA. I'm still associated, but I haven't taught a class in a while because I've just been, I picked up another job that pays better. Sorry, NYFA, but I'm not sorry. Anyways, you can keep that in. That's fine. I'll probably get sued by NYFA or whatever. So I went to a screening and it was this documentary and produced by Blumhouse. And I've always dreamed about working with Blumhouse. So I went there and I show up and it's a Green Light Women event. And I'm like, crap. I'm surrounded by this sea of like women that are going to watch the movie. I'm like, oh, this is great. I just didn't see the little part of the invite that said it's a Green Light Women event. And so I was planning on going up to the Blumhouse exec and saying, hey, I'm Brad. And, you know, I had a number one film on Netflix. Will you read my stuff? Will you take a meeting with me? But then I was having second thoughts. I was like, is this appropriate? Like, is this not cool? And so I had this kind of internal debate of going, you know, do I go up to this guy or not in this event? And eventually I said, oh man, I just, I'll make up for it somehow. And I went up to the guy before the event started and just pulled him aside really briefly and I go, hey, I'm Braden. I had a number one film on Netflix, you know, came out the same week as Idris Elba's Concrete Cowboy and this, and it still went to number one for 4 days. And, you know, I have a lot of ideas. I'd love to work with Blumhouse. You know, is there any way we could set up a meeting? And he was nice enough to give me his email.
Oh, wow.
And so hopefully, you know, I get a meeting. That'd be like one of my first industry meetings, you know, that would be huge. So I, you know, I'm kind of constantly like stuff like that is I think the stuff you have to do. Like I went to the screening last night, you know, I didn't know anybody, but I tried to go and meet a few people and introduce myself and find out what everyone's working on. And that's really all you can do when you don't have the ability to connect as much as you'd like to, I think.
Wow. Crazy.
Yeah.
Looks like we're right up against the time. We probably don't have time for our final five questions.
Well, we could do rapid fire if you want to. I mean, we have, I think, 2 to 3 minutes with Braden right now.
Yeah, I'm good for a little bit. So.
Okay, cool. All right, well, I'll go first. So what's the first film you made and how do you feel about it now?
The first film I made, I think, was actually at film school with Liz, USC. And I like it, but I also prefer a lot of my other stuff. So it was about a guy who becomes obsessed with a painting and he doesn't understand why. And it's actually because it speaks to, you know, it's the gaze. It's the Lacanian version of the gaze. I was a film theory major in undergrad and he just becomes obsessed with it to the point where he falls asleep next to it and it gives him this really dark nightmare of a dream and he wakes up and he like murders the painting. like just tears it apart. I love it. I still appreciate it. I learned a lot and I think that was the key with your first film, right?
Yeah.
I agree. What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received or witnessed or dispensed? Whatever.
Write cheap. That was probably the best. And cast. Your advice about cast was pivotal, I think. And yeah, one of the first feature screenplays, I think it was the second feature screenplay I wrote, was like a $10 million film. It was basically an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, but modern day, because I'm super against capital punishment. And so I was trying to kind of create this scenario where we were in the mind of a person while they were undergoing that. And it's probably at least a $10 million film. And I sent it to a friend and he loved it. And he said, Brad, listen, nobody's ever going to give you $10 million to make a movie. Nobody's going to give you $3 million to make a movie. Nobody knows who you are. Nobody gives a shit about you. Go write cheap and just go make it. And that's when I started writing cheap scripts. And I wrote three scripts and one of them ended up being Viscous, which ended up getting made. So it was good advice.
What's the worst feeling advice you've ever received?
man. I don't know if there's like a particular worst advice I've gotten, but I do feel that there is a culture in film of competitiveness that I think is misguided. I personally don't buy into that. I think we can support our friends. I don't think we have to have envy. I don't think we have to be jealous. Some of my closest relationships are with fellow filmmakers that I really believe in their talent. I'm very close with Marty Goh, who's shooting her third feature now. I'm really excited for her. I'm really close with Daniel Hanna, who's just shot his second feature, is about to make his third. I'm actually going to help produce his third because I just love the script and I just want to get it made. However, whatever I have to do to get it made, I'm going to help him get it made. Anna James, I'm really close with because she's just such a fucking rock star. You know, like there's nothing that's stopping you from supporting your fellow filmmaker. You know, like it takes nothing and it means the world to them.
Yeah.
Why are we competitive with each other? You think of an industry with like $14 billion or whatever it is, can't afford both of you? It can. Trust me, there's space for everyone. If you have the talent, which most of my friends do, then there's space for you. So stop being competitive with each other and just support one another, you know? And that goes back to film school, honestly, I think, that they taught that competitiveness. And I just think it's wrong and it's really unhealthy. And it's probably one of the things that eats us alive on the inside a little bit and probably hurts us.
I just really quickly to interject, like I don't think you can help but compare yourself to others. Like that's just natural, you know, like you're just going to do that, you know, and it's not necessarily healthy, but it's just a thing that you will do as an artist. But I believe strongly that like if either three of us succeed, it's going to help the other two.
Right.
Any indie filmmaker who comes up, right? Like the Michael Cooglers, or not Michael Cooglers, Ryan Cooglers of the world. Like people who like started with low budget movies and then become big. Like all those success stories are great for us. You know, like the more people who like make movies and succeed and do well and keep on making movies, like the better it is for like all the indie filmmakers who want to make movies and continue. So I feel like I totally agree. Like just supporting each other and helping each other is like the best thing in the world that we could do.
100%, I think.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
To just make a living doing it. That's really, maybe that's setting the bar too low. But yeah, you know, I've yet to make enough to pay rent, let alone survive off this. So I would just really like to, you know, just let's put it this way. I'd love to not have three jobs and write scripts on the side. I'd love to just, that's it. All I have to do is write a script. You know, like that would be like heaven, you know, if I ever was paid enough that I could just focus on creating, and that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And the other goal is really to help friends that help me and like rise up together, like as much as we can, you know.
If you could go back in time, what's one piece of advice you would give yourself?
I think I would have told myself even earlier to just go and make something for and no more shorts, right? You know, like make a feature, just even if it's a $50,000 feature, even if it's a $10,000, just find a way, make it. You know, even if you have to meal it together, just figure it out. And oh, and another thing, and this is not a negative on Sundance, I would just say like, fuck Sundance, fuck all these
companies. Oh yeah, that's not negative.
well, no. Like I am very, like I very hope to be at Sundance one day. Like I don't want to say negative things about Sundance, but the idea that Sundance is the only way to ascend is problematic. And I know so many people that are still waiting on the Sundance Lab. You know, like they that's their plan, is that they're going to get into the Sundance Lab and that's going to change everything. Or they're going to win a screenwriting competition. I haven't submitted to a screenwriting competition in like 7 years. And it's nothing against the screenwriting competitions. I'm sure they have the right intentions. But I know two people who have won the Nichols Fellowship and it did not do anything for them. That's the Nichols Fellowship. You take a working screenwriter right now and you put him in the Nichols Fellowship, he might not win. They might not win. Like literally, it's that competitive of a thing. And these people won it and it didn't do much for them. You know, like so stop thinking about the competitions, the Sundances, the Nichols, and just as much as you can, even if it's $5,000, try to make a feature, you know, shoot it on an iPhone if you have to. Just make it, because you can actually sell that. And you just have to call Liz and pay her fee. and she will sell it for you.
My fee may be more than the budget, unfortunately. Don't call me. Yes. But I'm happy to help anyone.
It's money well spent. It's money well spent.
You know? Is making movies hard?
Absolutely. Toughest thing in the world, and that's also why it's awesome.
Brendan, this is such a good... I love this.
Yeah,
so
this
much.
Is amazing. Where should people go if they want to learn more about you? Where should they watch your movie? Where should they find you to find your work?
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Yeah, What Lies Below, originally titled Viscous, is still on Netflix. It'll be on there until, I think, April of next year. So you can check it out there. You can also, I think it's on Tubi. I think you can, if you want to rent it for some reason, you can rent it on VOD. And then for me, I'm at @director_BRD on Twitter and Instagram. And my website is www.rangerfilms.com, where you can see my shorts and all my no budget music videos that I did for Snoop Dogg's company back in the day, which is a whole other story. So,
amazing.
But those are my no budget music videos. So enjoy those.
All right, Arik, what do you remember about our talk with Braden?
I remember that he watched my movie before our interview, and then I didn't watch his, and I felt very, very bad about it. I watched the trailer, but I didn't watch his movie. So, Braden, I did watch your movie. You know, good job. Thank you very much for watching mine. I just felt like crap for not watching it before the thing. What else I remember? I just remember he was so wonderful, so open, so honest about the whole experience of making his movie and getting it out there. You know, it was fascinating to hear about how, you know, he started just like I did, you know, just the same way that I approached The Alternate, like trying to make it for, you know, really low budget. And then the budget just got higher and higher and higher. And then eventually, you know, he's making it, and then it gets, you know, picked up by this big distributor, and then it gets picked up by Netflix. And it was very, very cool to hear the whole story of how it was formed. It was a little unfortunate to hear about the reception of the movie and how he dealt with that, you know, because that's never fun. I mean, I had my own little brief experience with it on The Alternate, but I mean, not to that level at all. And so, you know, and definitely not on that big of a level. I'm sure if the Alternate had been on Netflix, I would probably have the same problem. But yeah, I mean, dude, crazy. But I really love the conversation. I mean, I feel like he's so talented. It's shocking to me that he doesn't have another movie that he's already working on, that's already like in pre-production and all set up. But I guess it just goes to show how hard this whole thing is. It's like, just because you have massive success and get to the highest of heights, it doesn't guarantee anything in your future. So it's just another lesson in the toughness of filmmaking. But what about you, Liz? What do you remember?
No, it's a really good point. I'm thinking about how I always get really jealous of other people's success. And then this is a great reminder that those benchmarks that we seek for some reason don't necessarily guarantee emotional or financial success for our careers. Like, it reminded me a little bit of the Savannah Block episode where we interviewed Savannah, and she won like a jury prize at LAFF when that was still going. And then she just had this crazy experience in distribution. And it's like, merit and talent and hard work do not guarantee any sort of career boost. You have to hit things at the right time, the right zeitgeist, and you can't control people's responses or reactions to it. I also remember, I mean, Braden's a friend and he's a sweetheart. And at the end of the interview, he said something about how he really thinks that we can all just support each other, and that he really is happy for the success of his colleagues and his peers. And he says that, but he also walks the walk. Like, I think every screening I've ever had, Braden has been there. Like, I think he's always sending little notes to people. I mean, it's just like, he's very supportive of the filmmaking community, and that's super rare. So it's like, be like Braden, right? Be like, he's lovely.
Yeah. Support your fellow filmmakers. I really like that he said that too, because I totally agree. I feel like that's the only way to be, you know, it's like, we just got to support each other. We can't be jealous of each other. I mean, we will be, because we can't help it, but you know, we need to, you know, be supportive, you know, and yeah, because everyone else's success is just going to help our success as well. So I have more things to talk about, but I think it's the game time.
I'm like motioning to Arik to do the voice.
Oh, the voice. And here we have another round of the game.
Okay, so the game, for those who are unfamiliar, is a challenge. Our producer, Eric Toms, has set up an indie film quagmire, as I like to phrase. And it's confronted with this problem. How would you, Alric Bursell of Making Movies Is Hard / The Alternate, answer this challenge? Alric, you may want to take notes because this is very, very specific.
I'm ready.
And we may amend the question after I say it out loud, but I want you to hear the whole thing. Okay. And it came to us from Zoe Eisenberg, who I'm meeting in like 3 hours. So Zoe, looking forward to our meeting. Okay. So Alric, you are directing a micro budget feature. Less than 200K is the stipulation.
Okay. Sounds familiar.
Yes. It's your baby. You wrote it. It's your special favorite child is what she, I love that. And you've been pushing it for years. And now you're finally going into production. Your financing mostly comes from friends and family connections. And it took you years to cobble it all together. Your shoot is going to be 13. This is so familiar for everyone. Your shoot is going to be 13 days. And you plan to make most of the time by using a 2-camera setup. You have a crew of 17, including yourself. Okay. So what Zoe did is, this is where it gets difficult. She listed out all 17 positions.
Okay.
And I will say them in a second, but I want to get through the whole question first. 3 weeks before production, one of your financiers drops out and you and your producer are not convinced you can find a replacement since it took so long to find your fundraising in the first place. Your producer proposes you make up for the lost money by either cutting 2 production days, which would be 11-day shoot, or cutting 2 crew members. So do you choose a shorter shoot, a smaller crew, or something else that doesn't involve raising more money? And if you cut your crew, who would go? Okay, do you want to hear who you have right now in your crew?
I would love to hear who I have, and I already know what side of this I'm going to go on, but I want to hear the crew positions first.
Okay. So you have you, you have your producer, you have your production coordinator moonlighting as a driver, you have a UPM, you have a first AD, you have a DP, and separately a camera op, a first AC, a script supervisor, a grip, a gaffer, a sound mixer. I'm hoping that sound mixer includes boom operator because they don't mention boom operator here, but like, why would you not? So I'm going to say that's a boom / sound mixer. DIT / dailies editor. Well, that's very interesting. Production designer, art PA, production PA, and then one hair and makeup person.
Cut the scripty, cut the DIT. Done.
No, wait. But your DIT is also a dailies editor. You don't care?
I'll do it.
You'll
That's
do
what
it.
I did on my movie anyway. So I did the dailies on the alternate. I had my whole editing set up with me in the room that I was staying in. So when I wrapped, I went and I processed the footage because we didn't have a DIT.
God,
so like
Alric.
Basically me and the second AD, like I was the DIT basically with the second AC. So we kind of, well, I guess she really did it, but I kind of like, we kind of did it together. Like she would start and then if it didn't finish and I would finish at the end of the day.
And you are presuming that you're editing this, right? Because so you're saying
and
you need a scripty.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I, so this is just, oh my God. So here's the thing about scripties. I didn't plan on for a scripty on my movie. The day before we started, or 2 days before we started, my producer was like, I think my first AD or my producer, somebody was like, we don't have a scripty. We need to have a scripty. And I was like, we don't need a scripty. I've been a scripty before. I don't need it. I have my own scripty. It's fine. And then I guess I just kept on getting pressured like through my producer. And they're like, we have to have a scripty. We have to. So we got one. Wonderful person. Loved the scripty. She was great. I can think of maybe one time where she actually caught something that I didn't. Maybe once or twice. And all her wonderful notes and everything, did I use them? I'd love to say I did. I did not. So I just don't think it's that needed. Like I'm doing this budget for this movie right now and I put in the scripty because I know that they're going to be like, we need to have a scripty. But I swear to God, I don't think we need a scripty always. Like unless you're like, it's so big or whatever. And like, you don't have the time to like be staring at the monitor and you're just like working with the actors the whole time. But like, I like to stare at the monitor. Like I like to work with the actors and I like to go stare at the monitor.
Right.
And there's usually the production designer. There's me. There's the DP. And then there's sometimes another person like wardrobe or somebody else who's around who they're everyone scrutinizing the monitor. So we have like 4 scripties there looking for continuity because there's because somebody in the arts job is to look for continuity issues. So there's already like double backups for this.
Yeah, but in this shoot, you only have one production designer and one art PA.
I just think that like it's a sacrifice. Okay. And especially if you've never done because I have the benefit of having been a scripty before and I have editing experience. So I've kind of have these two skill sets that I can put to use on the movie. But I mean, I still think that you can make up for those two positions and that you don't really want to steal from production. You don't want to steal from art. There's only two lighting people anyways. Like if there was a third lighting person, I would maybe steal from them, you know? And I mean, my gaffer and key grip people might be cursing at me right now, but like they can figure it out, right? Like we can just use less lights. Like it'll be okay. Like our cameras these days are good enough where, you know, if you don't have time to light everything amazingly, you're going to be okay. And you can't steal from camera because they're shooting two cameras and they only have a 3-person camera team. It's like, you know, not counting the DIT. That's why the DIT can go because like they're not a part of the camera operations, right? So yeah, I mean, that's just that's the clear way I would see it. I don't know. But what about you, Liz? Like what would you do in that situation? Would you cut days?
No, I have an idea, but this two camera thing is very interesting to me because I would assume that two camera may even restrict your movement rather than free you up, and it may create more lighting challenges. I mean, again, I'm not looking at shot lists. You're not looking at shot lists. We're not looking at storyboards, but it feels like each camera is going to be 30 degrees from each other. And so you can get just slight variations of the same shot and more coverage. Is that the idea? Or is there something I'm missing about this two camera setup?
So I guess it depends on what type of movie it is, right? So if it's a comedy, you could potentially be shooting each actor at the same time. So you could be doing that, which is going to cause lots of lighting problems and your gaffer's going to hate you. But if you do global lighting, you could probably make it work. The other way to do it is to have like a wide and a close up, you know, from each camera. And then that saves you time because you don't have to switch lenses and go into the tight. I don't like the two camera idea. Like that's just not how I like to work. I like working with one camera and just getting the shots done and like not overcomplicating it. The only time I like to bring in multiple cameras is for like a really expensive, you know, practical effect where like
you overcover the scene to make sure
you're blowing
somebody
up or you're ripping off something or you're doing something that you can only do once or twice. Then I like to bring in all the other cameras to set them up to like make sure that we're getting it. And we did that in the finale of my movie. And I think we had 4 or 5 cameras going in and it was great. And I think I used every angle in the edit anyways. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, you could cut the second camera. That would be another option.
I'm looking at this list. I'm guessing the DP is operating one camera and the second camera op is there. That's just listed as camera op. I mean, the DP that I usually work with is Julia Swain and she likes to operate. So for me, I would probably consolidate to a one camera setup, you know, get rid of the second camera operator. That saves you money, right? Because you're no longer renting a second camera and you're getting rid of one of those positions. And if I really had to do something else, maybe, you know, I never had a production coordinator and a UPM, but I don't like the idea of the driver being two things. Like, I think if you're driving, like that's, you need to be like fully awake, not exhausted, not having a tough day that day. Like I would probably, someone's going to kill me. I consolidate UPM and production coordinator. And then I'd like be very careful with the hours of the driver, right? Like, and that might mean that you spend a little bit more money for the driver or you put them on off hours or you give them a break in between. So I think I would adjust in that.
What would you use your driver for? Like, would they be like just to drive like, you know, cast and crew to and from set or would they also be doing runs? Like what?
Oh, my presumption is that you don't get to walk away at the end of the day and that you have to keep equipment in the truck somewhere and drive that truck to a guarded, a safeguarded area.
So they're not driving team. They're just driving equipment.
Well, that's I've worked in so low budget. Like, I don't even know what the traditional definition of a driver is. My experience with the driver is like on Witchy, someone had to return the truck with all the rentals at the end of the day, or someone had to bring that truck to a guarded lot. And it's like, you just worked a 12 to 14 hour day. I don't want that person being my production coordinator. I don't want that person being my UPM. So I guess it matters how you're using the driver.
Usually, like in my experience, that's like the lighting and the grip team. They like kind of figure out that plan, you know, with the producers. So it's like, oh, we're either going to leave the truck overnight, you know, or if it has to go back someplace, then we'll we'll make sure that that person has a later start so they're not burnt out, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and then they'll stagger. So like one person will drive the truck there, then they'll have an earlier, you know, wrap time, and then another person will start later, and then they'll, you know, whatever. But
that person being the production coordinator when you have just that seems bad.
Well, I assume that like the driver in the production, in that scenario, I assume that the driver meant production coordinator driver meant that they were like driving key cast usually to set, or
they're like the shuttle driver.
Yeah, they're the shuttle driver and they're doing runs and they're kind of a runner,
maybe production
coordinator driver mix person.
Yeah, we need more information, Zoe, on what this driver is responsible for. But I think we have meaningful input on your question.
It sounds like a stressful situation.
Yeah.
My God. I mean, I had similar stresses with my movie, not about losing finances, but like not having it and like trying to find it right before. And then luckily it all kind of came together in the last minute.
Well, to be fair, this isn't Zoe's, I don't want to imply that this is Zoe's situation with her film right now, but I think she's constructed something. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Like Eric's response to this said this has to be real. It's so specific. This must have happened to the person writing the question, which maybe is true. I mean, I'm thinking that maybe this is something that happened and that they dealt with in one way and they wanted to hear what our take would be on it, you know? But yeah, Zoe, tell us more. Did this actually happen to you? And what did you do in this situation? Would love to hear if that's actually a true thing, or if this is something that you're going through right now. My apologies. But there is a way to get through this. But this was a great question. This was a fun one. I like the multiple choice ones, but I also like something like this that has like a very specific, you know, breakdown of like what you would do, you know. It's fun. Are you a writer with a great screenplay just sitting on your desktop? Are you looking for written analysis of your work by experienced creatives? Are you trying to get industry professionals to read your work, but you don't know how to reach them?
Then enter the Blue Cat Screenplay Competition. Created by veteran screenwriter Gordon Hoffman, the Blue Cat Screenplay Competition has helped unknown writers launch their professional careers for over 25 years.
This year, the Blue Cat Screenwriting Competition will award $18,500 in cash, and everyone who enters will receive a written analysis on their work, and getting feedback on your script is worth like a lot.
The deadline to enter is October 30th, but if you miss it, you could still catch their late deadline on December 11th.
Check them out on the social medias at Blue Cat Writers on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
So stop waiting to be discovered and send your feature screenplay, TV pilot, and short film script to Blue Cat today. And the deadline to enter is October 30th, but if you miss it, you can still catch their late deadline on December 11th, and you can use our code, all caps, BCHARD23. For $10 off.
I don't know. Should we talk about other stuff, Liz, or should we just wrap this up? Let's wrap it up. I feel like I have something to say, but I don't really feel like it's that important. So we'll.
Do you want to just say it and then we could cut it if it's not important?
Yeah, I guess I was just, you know, the whole Braden episode and everything, and like going through my own movie and like talking to other filmmakers, and it just feels like, man, like you basically have to have like crazy high success in order for a feature to like actually change your career as a filmmaker. Like you've got to have like, you won Sundance, you know, not just getting into Sundance. It's like you have to win Sundance.
You realize you're like 180 from something you said months ago. This is like an ongoing
months ago.
We've had this conversation twice where you've said you're just a minor success away from breaking out in your career. Like that was the argument you said, but now you're saying you have to get massive success in order to have an impact in your career. What is that, right?
It feels that way. I mean, I don't know. Like it seems like the more and more we talk to people, it's like, I don't know what minor success I was prefer. Like, I feel like maybe I was saying like, I think you are one success away from your career changing, but I don't think it's minor. It has to be major, you know, like it has to be like your movie goes viral and like, you know, blows up in a big way, you know, and it feels like, but that's seemingly that's what happened to Braden, right? Like he had that huge success. He got into Netflix, you know, he had a lot of people watching it. He got all these eyeballs and then nothing. So like, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's not true. Maybe it really does have to be like the big thing to actually turn the dial, you know, or make something happen. Because,
well, who do you think is successful? Who is who's like the career you want, who we've talked to?
Jeff Bana.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He's constantly making movies, right?
Yeah. Or Riley Starnes, you know, you know, these guys who just make movie after movie, and they have, you know, movie stars in their movies, and they're able to get them funded and to go, you know, that seems like the kind of the goal, right? You know, it feels like a lot of people have these really great successes, but then they're sort of, you know, stuck, you know, I guess that Kestrin Pantera, she seems to be like riding the wave of because didn't she just have another feature come out?
I think so. She's doing really well. And then Amber Seely is doing really well.
Yeah. Like there are other examples.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just like really killing it, you know, but it's like, I feel like all those people had a massive success that kind of got them to that level.
Or a person, right? Or a person that connected them, right? It's like for Mira, it was Mark Stoleroff recommending her. And then she did her homework and she did a great pitch. Right. I was thinking last night of all the pitches that I totally bungled in my life, where like I like didn't prepare at all. I didn't even know it was a pitch or a general. I just went in thinking they wanted to hang out. I didn't get it, right? And hindsight is 2020, but what great learning lessons those things were. But on a separate note, my sister listens to our podcast. She just listens to the first 5 minutes, by the way, and then she turns it off.
Oh, funny.
But she did say, she implied that we should ask more whether people are happy or not, because we're so obsessed with these career landmarks things. And we think these people are happy. Like, if I hadn't talked to Brad, and I wouldn't have known that there was a little bit of a backlash against this film, because all I saw from my vantage point was Netflix top 10. He got like a lot of press, XYZ, big actors, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like, who's happy? Who have we talked to who's happy? Has anyone ever expressed that they're happy?
I don't know. I mean, some, I guess, you know. I mean, some people, like Malgo Zerzada Sumoska.
Yeah.
Yeah, she seemed pretty happy.
Did she? I mean, she seemed confident about her career. But like, I don't know. I think that we're never going to be happy. We're always going to be striving for bigger, better, the next project, to better ourselves, to become, you know, more and more impressive and substantial directors, no matter what.
I guess what I'm saying is like, it's like the you know, it's back to that whole thing that, you know, Mark Duplass said like years and years ago at South by Southwest. It's like the cavalry's never coming. Like, I feel like to get the cavalry, it's you really have to win.
There's no cavalry, is what I'm saying. He's saying it. I'm saying it. There's no cavalry.
There is for select few, right? Like, for select few, there is, you know, for people who manage to get an agent, get a manager, you know, get the deal where they're suddenly the doors are opening to them, where they're getting the pitches and having the opportunities. Like, I feel like that does happen. It just takes a tremendous success in order to get there, you know?
Well, it's the stories. It's the way we tell our stories. So, like, you and I are one actor attachment away from a greenlit film, right?
But that's because we did it. That's because we hustled.
We didn't,
right? Like, it's not because someone bestowed upon you this opportunity. You went after it. Like, you made it happen. Right?
No, I would say the sci-fi film, I pitched on it. Then we've been doing it in development for 2 years.
But how did you get the pitch opportunity for it?
I think they were looking for a female director, and Tom Putnam, who was on that project, saw Speed of Life, which was a sci-fi film. And I just happened to have made a grounded sci-fi when they were looking for a grounded sci-fi female director. Mm. And I was in his network, and he could easily email me, right? Mm. I was the low effort option. And then it's very small incremental progress for the next 2 years until I have something that feels like it's substantial.
Yeah.
And then when people talk to us, they tell us a 5-year story in 30 seconds, and it feels like machinations were moving without them pushing, right? It feels like someone came in and there was a cavalry.
So in your mind, it's like that project is a result of Speed of Life, basically.
Yeah, and me knowing Tom Putnam. Yeah.
Oh, and you just having the connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But because he didn't find Speed of Life without knowing you. He knew you.
No, he emailed me one day and said, "Saw your movie, I loved it. Do you want to talk about something?" And I think he probably watched it because he was thinking about women directors that he knew. And he was looking for a director for this film. And when I read Amy Starbin's script and fell in love with it, that's the other thing, right? I didn't bungle the interview because I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
But I bungled a bunch of things that could have been very fruitful for me. But I bungled them because I didn't understand what they were. So it's like, I agree that there's a level of chance and support that come into it. And I agree there's a hustle, but I also, it's at least unhealthy for me to think that they have something that I don't have, right? It's like makes me feel sad.
Oh, yeah, the people who get skyrocketed or whatever.
Yeah. It's like we have it within ourselves. It just takes a long time.
Yeah. I guess it's not like, I guess in, me, in my mind, it's, I don't think that's like they have something. It's like they're not more special than anybody else, right? Yeah. They just happen to have this roll of the dice that paid off, you know, this huge, I don't know. It's, I wouldn't say winning a lottery ticket because I don't want to take away from their hard work. Like they obviously made a great movies and they got to that level. But like everybody makes really great movies, right? There's a lot of great movies out in the world that don't ever get attention. But yeah, I guess it's all like the things. It all adds up, right? Like it's all the connections that you make and the relationships that you develop. I think it really comes down to that. But like, I guess, I don't know. I wonder one day if something will be handed to either of us and then we'll be able to talk about what that experience is like.
Yeah.
Or if it's always going to be the same thing where it's just like you're constantly grinding it out until you get to that point where something can or cannot be made or does not happen.
I was reading an article where Charlize Theron was saying how hard it was for her to get films financed.
Yeah, I read that too. I was like kind of blown away by that, you know, because, but I wonder like how true, on what level is that true? Like, right? Like, can she not get $100 million movie made that she wants to make that's like her own thing that she's like really excited about? Or is she not being able to get like a $5 million movie made? I cannot believe that Charlize Theron can't get a $5 million movie made. I'm like, people got to be lining up around the block to get
that would be very Charlize surprising.
In a $5 million movie. It's just everyone's level of, it goes back to what you just said earlier. It's like everybody's level of like success and happiness is all different. And so like Charlize Theron's level of success and happiness, like she's not feeling like she's famous enough to green light the movies that she wants to green light. But that's because they're like 50 million, 100 million, whatever dollar movies, you know, but like she could easily green light much lower budget movies if she was willing to do that. But like, that's not success to her, or that's not the kind of movies that she's trying to make, right? So like she can't make a $5 million movie because that's not, like her projects wouldn't work at $5 million. They only work at,
well, who knows? Whatever. We don't know. We're not Charlize. I mean,
that's all you can assume, I guess, you know, but.
Or things are that crazy, or she's, you know, the way that this culture values youth over, you know, over age and experience.
There's no way. I guarantee you that like, if I went to my people and I was like, we could get Charlize Theron in this movie, they'd be like, all right, this is the number that she is equal to.
Yeah.
We can get an MG if we get Charlize Theron in this movie, but there's no way I could get Charlize Theron in this movie because she's too big, you know?
And maybe
but
she's like, expecting things to be easy, right? You know, like she, as an actress, is handed roles and the films are funded. And I know she's got a lot of experience on the other side, but maybe the expectation is that it should be easy for her because she's earned it.
Yeah.
And she has. She's amazing. She has.
Oh my God. Yeah, for sure. I mean, and there's probably like a million scripts that she's getting passed that she's passing on because they're like not good. Right. And it's like, well, she has this thing that she wants to do and then they're not accepting that in the same way. And it's like, that must be really frustrating.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you want to make this movie with me for $100 million? This script's terrible. Like, I have a great script for $100 million and them saying, no, we don't want to go for it.
Yeah.
Like, that's got to be tough. And I mean, I could see a world where that would happen, even though it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But I could see it happening, right? And I could see why that would be frustrating for her. So, I don't know. Let's get Charlize on the phone, on the show. Charlize, come on the show. Tell us all about it. We'd love to have you. This would be a fun conversation. Anyways, this has been great, Liz. Thank you for this therapy corner. It's always good. It's always good.
Thank you.
If you want to, you know, send us a question, comment, or suggestion, if there's some of your own therapy you'd like us to discuss on the show, you can email us at podcast@mickeymoviesishard.com. Or if you really like the show and love what you're hearing, you can leave us a review or a rating on iTunes or any of the other places. We haven't had an iTunes review in a couple months, about time. So, you know, if anyone is interested, we would love that. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. We have not been putting the episodes on YouTube lately because I was supposed to take up the slack since Jeff had his move. I didn't. So yeah, that is out of date, but it will be up to date at some point. I will pledge to get it done. Also, don't forget to check out Jambox.io. They're a royalty-free music and sound effects company with an emphasis on high-quality cinematic cues they deliver, I can tell from experience. Their composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, working with directors like Michael Bay and Martin Scorsese,
And they even offer customized plans to fit your needs, which is pretty great. And you can use our code MMIH for a 20% discount on your subscription. Do that today. Thanks so much to Brad and Domelier for coming on the show. And to Liz.
For me.
For setting this whole thing up. This is really amazing. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome and continuing to make this game that we're playing, the game, so fun. And then also thanks to Zoe Eisenberg for sending in the question, because that was a really great one. And we want to hear more, Zoe. Tell us more. Thanks, y'all, for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Jeff will be okay, like, yeah, this guy is thinking about me? Oh, man, this is great.
He's so thoughtful.
Thanks, Jeff, for not making me look like an idiot.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.